Behavioral Health Integrations Podcast strives to inspire the next generation of mental health and addiction specialists. Our aim is to continue to raise awareness and encourage collaboration in the mental health and addiction industry so that it will continue to thrive. There are numerous approaches to treating mental health and substance abuse issues. On this show, we take pleasure in showcasing the diversity of these approaches used to improve the lives of others. So without further ado, your host, Jacob Minnig.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to another Behavior Health Integration episode. Today, I have special guest, Dr. Kerry Yazid. Dr. Kerry Yazid is a behavioral specialist. She is a work culture researcher. She is a three-time best-selling author and has a new book, new release, Unbreak My Soul, How Black Women Can Begin to Heal from Workplace Trauma. Dr. Kerry Yazid specializes in workplace trauma. She, on this episode, will be discussing the many different ways individuals can handle workplace trauma to better set boundaries with others and what to do when workplace trauma occurs. I, for one, am very excited to have her on the show. So without further ado, let's get started. Dr. Kerry, thank you so much for being on the show today. I really appreciate it.
Well, thank you so much for having me. It's a pleasure to be here.
Yeah, I'm very excited. I know we're going to get into a lot of great stuff, and it's going to be a fun educational ride.
Yep, that's what we're planning on having.
So where are you calling from again?
I am from Louisiana. I am 60 miles outside of New Orleans and 30 miles outside of the state capital. I stay in a rural area.
And that's where you grew up?
No, it's actually where I moved for peace and quiet.
I grew up
in the state capital. I grew up in Baton Rouge, Louisiana.
Okay, interesting. All right.
And I moved to the country.
Well, it's always good to have some peace and quiet.
Yes, it is. It is.
I've always enjoyed being a suburban boy where I'm not too far in the country. But if I want to hang out, do some things in the city, it's like a good 20, 30 minutes away. So,
yeah, that kind of describes where we are. Like we do have like, shopping centers, and we have major stores, but it's not as congested as living in the city. You know, we get to see like, sometimes we get an alligator spotting here and there, but it's usually rabbits and ducks and snakes. Like we get that kind of stuff.
Okay. Interesting. Yeah. I wouldn't even know what to do if I saw an alligator or a crocodile. I just would freak out.
We don't either. We just call animal control.
Oh, geez. Yeah. So right off the bat, I have to ask you as we move along, what originally made you passionate about the mental health addiction field and so forth? Like what motivates you to get in it?
Oh, let's see. I actually was a psychology major for my undergrad at Southern. And I was supposed to go to law school.
Really?
So, yeah. I always tell people I was supposed to go to law school. That's what my family had planned on. And I did an internship in undergrad at a group home.
Okay.
And I really enjoyed like the work that we were doing. And so then I asked one of like the supervisors, like, what did you get like your degree in? And so she was telling me like she had a master's in social work. Okay. And so I was just like, oh, like, because I was a psychology major. Mm-hmm. And so she's like, well, yeah, you can still get your master's in social work. So she actually told me about the program at Tulane. She made an introduction to like the admissions committee. She did that introduction for me and I got accepted, and it was like the rest was history. Like I did it for 23 years.
How did your parents and family take it when you said, yeah, I don't want to be a lawyer anymore?
Well, they actually didn't find out until my graduation dinner from Tulane that they realized I didn't get a law degree, that I had a degree in social work. Okay. So it was kind of like some screaming, some yelling, what did you do?
Yeah.
And it was like, so you're going to law school? And it was just like, not right now. And like, I just never got around to it.
Okay. Was there a lot of people in your family with college degrees, or do you have any lawyers in your family? And is that the reason they more so wanted you to be an attorney? Or
no, I would have actually been the first lawyer in the family.
Oh, wow.
I was actually the first I was actually the first person in my family, well, no, the first female in my family to
Okay.
graduate with a bachelor's degree. And I
Nice.
was the only person in my family at that time to have a master's degree. And I'm the only person in my family to have a PhD.
Wow. That's again one heck of an accomplishment for everyone, or I mean just yeah, just incredible. I mean, I thought getting my master's was a burnout. I can't imagine a PhD program and
Yeah, so I'm definitely a first generation, but I would have been a first generation lawyer as well. But and years later, I did try. I went to like open house at law school, and you got to sit in a class. And I found myself like on social media and was like, "When is this over with?" Like I was so bored, and I was like, "Oh, I can't go to law school." Like so, that's when I knew at that point, like that wasn't in the cards for me.
Wait, was this before PhD or after PhD again?
This was actually during PhD.
Oh, wow.
And someone invited me and I went to sit through, I sat through like open house and I was just like, this is boring. Like this, I don't do this.
But if you were interested, you would have done probably another 3 years of education.
No, I probably, if I was interested, I probably would have stopped my PhD program
Okay.
and started law school. But
Ah, okay.
it didn't, nah, it was like not, that was like not
Yep.
my thing. Can we pause for one second?
Yeah.
One of my kids is calling me.
Please, yeah, no worries.
Okay.
Yeah. So, just curious, was there some aspects you took from law into being a social worker, like policy, regulations? Again, I know we'll later get into like the harassment stuff and
Silly, no, I think for me, I never really did like policy when it came to like what I did like as a mental health therapist or as a social worker back then. My focus actually really was on working like with the survivor or the victim. Back then, my area of expertise, I worked with survivors of sexual assault. And so when it came to like law, I would say that I worked a lot of times like with law enforcement. And so we had a lot of that, where sometimes I would have to go in and interview like kids, and do like a play assessment. They really couldn't answer questions. And so using like tools, like toys and tools to get them to like open up and share like what had happened and then having to write a report and then filing that with the court system. Like, and so, and I did like, I was, you know, I had to do a lot of depositions and stuff like that. But like, trust me, going to law school didn't prepare me for that. Like, you just got that on your own. So, yeah.
And then what other type of jobs did you have a little bit after that then?
I did social work for 23 years, and mixed up
Wow.
in that time, I also did like some a college professor. So I did
Nice.
that for like 11 years. Sometimes I worked as an adjunct, and that would be like part time. And then I worked actually full time from 2011 to like 2016.
Okay. I gotta ask you a tough question. What do you like better, teaching or clinical work?
For me, I like teaching better because it allowed me to bring in my skills.
Okay. Absolutely. Then what eventually got you, let's say, passionate about like the avenue of sexual harassment prevention, workplace trauma? How did that transition go about?
Actually, that transition came about because I was in higher ed and I was actually. I went through sexual harassment on a college campus. And
Wow.
from there, I realized that they didn't have like the help that I needed. Like, when I reached out for like resources, people just like didn't know what to do. That wasn't supposed to happen to a college professor. And for in my case, it was a student that was sexually harassing me. And so people were like, "Oh, well, no, that's not how that happens." And it was just like, "Okay, I don't know how it happens, but this is what happened." And being pointed in the wrong direction, just not having like the support, being re-victimized over and over again when I went to file a police report, and I having a
Oh,
female
wow.
officer being having a male officer come in to take my report, and then being told, like, well, you know, this wouldn't have happened to you if you would have just went out on a date with him, and you know, this
No.
happening to you
Wait,
because
wait,
you're
wait, 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 wait,
pretty.
wait. That no, that was not said.
Yes, that was said.
What?
And technically,
What?
he didn't even write up a report. He kind of felt like I was just wasting his time.
I don't understand. Okay. Well, do you think majority of the battle too is maybe, let's say, women in your shoes are not necessarily aware of what's happening right away? Like, hey, this person's maybe behaving a little oddly. Like, what's going on here? And then once you become aware of that, what are the actions? What do you say to that person moving forward, right?
The first thing that they need to do is once you become, my thing is this, whenever you see that the behaviors are making you uncomfortable, you need to start documenting, because you might not even realize what's taking place in that moment. But if you document, you can go back and read over the documentation, maybe clarity will come then, or you can let someone that you feel safe with to read over your documentation and get like an opinion from them. And so in my case, it wasn't necessarily me documenting, but I had documentation as far as like memos, emails, like all of this information I was receiving, and I would print everything out and put it in a folder. And for the longest, everyone was making it seem like, oh, you're just making this up. This is all in your head. It's not that bad. And I was just like, no, this, I know this isn't in my head. And so when I went back and started reading over the documentation, that I still have to this day, even though it was all those years ago, I was just like, oh, this is bad. Like, this is worse than what I imagined. And so a part of me had actually become desensitized. And I was trying to normalize it because everyone around me was normalizing the experience, like, oh, that just happens. You have students who are just like flirty. And I'm just like, nah, this is like you, I got somebody that knows my schedule. Like they're waiting for me when I get out the car.
Oh,
Like they're
no.
waiting for me when they walk into my class and I don't even teach them and they're disrupting my classes. And like the icing on the cake was, because no one really was taking me seriously, was the student locked me in my office with the intentions of raping me.
Oh, no.
And then even at that point, it still was the, yeah, but he didn't, and he left, and so you just need to suck it up, and
Is
it's
that
gonna
supposed to make
be
you feel
okay.
better though? That's
I
what
guess.
is outrageous. Is like, is that supposed to be a relief for you that, oh, it just didn't happen?
I think for them, I think more so there, when I went started to go deep, I realized that the school didn't have any policies and procedures. Like they weren't even following the federal guidelines that you're supposed to when sexual harassment or assault is taking place on a college campus. And so I started bringing that to their attention, like, because they were like, oh, well, you need to go to the Title IX office. And I was like, where is that? Because it's not on your website. I don't even see where I can file like a formal complaint. Like, who do I talk to? Where are the resources? Like, none of that was available. And it actually, they didn't post it on their website until after I quit.
Oh, hey, and again, I'm sorry, I'm gonna go off on this situation a little bit. It's just like policies, procedure. Like, what about fucking being a human being? Like, if I was your boss and you told me this, I would comfort you. I would empathize with you. I don't need policy and procedures to do that. Or I would never, how dare, like, I would never say, oh, well, you didn't. Like, where's the humanity in that piece? Screw the policies. Where's the humanity in it?
And I think for me, that was the turning point. At that point, I had been in the field for like when it happened, like 22 years, because I left like a year later. And for me, that was like the, I think that turning point where it was just like I've given this profession and this field my entire life. Like this has been my entire career. I've been empathetic. I've worked with survivors of sexual assault, but here I am. I'm a professor, and I'm in a department with my peers. And this is how you're treating me as a colleague What do you do with your clients? But B, this isn't what I thought it would be. Like, where's the empathy and compassion for me as just a human being, not as a
Yes.
professional, but just a human being that's telling you they're going through this, that has experienced this. And so it kept snowballing out of effect. Basically, it went from like the student locked me in my office,
Oh,
and I also
God.
had some other things to take place. So my dad had also died that year, and I was
Oh.
his caregiver, and he was my last surviving parent.
Okay.
So I was dealing with that. We also had a flood, and so
Oh.
my car got flooded.
Oh, man.
So I was having transportation issues, and it was all of these other things that I was dealing with. And there was just no understanding. It was just like, you're just supposed to continue to perform and go through the motions. And I found myself, and so for me, this is where like the work trauma and really saying like, if I ever get through this, I'm gonna make sure no one else goes
Yes.
through this or they don't
Amen.
go through this alone. Because even though I had been a clinician, I didn't realize I had developed PTSD.
Yeah.
And so every time a bell rung, because the student would wait for me outside of the elevator. And so when the
Oh.
bell and the elevator would ding to be on that floor, from my brain, it was just like, oh God, please don't let him be there. And he would usually
Oh.
be there. And so then it became every time I heard a bell, I would like jump or I started having a
Yeah.
panic attack. Then I realized that as I was trying to use my computer at work, my hands would shake
Yep.
constantly. And so I would have to hold one hand.
Oh.
I'm right-handed, so I would have to take my left hand to hold my right hand just to type. So I started doing more work at home where I
Yep.
didn't shake as much. So trying to make accommodations for myself. And it just got so bad that one day I had a meltdown at work.
Yeah.
And fortunately, I had a mental health team. So I was seeing a psychiatrist and I was seeing a counselor.
Okay.
And I immediately called my counselor and told her like what had happened, because I basically like cussed out the whole faculty. Like I just had it.
Yeah.
Like we were in a meeting and I just had it.
Yeah. A
And
meeting about your situation or a meeting about
no,
just general
we were
stuff?
having a faculty meeting.
Yeah.
And at some point in the faculty meeting, the gaslighting started where
I
they
was just
started.
thinking that. Yep.
Yeah. So I'm sitting there and I'm not bothering anybody. So I would kind of just like fade into the wallpaper.
Some of your language a little bit earlier in this interview, I'm like, oh, they're gaslighting her a little bit there.
Yeah, it was definitely gaslight, but I didn't realize that it was gaslighting. So I didn't know
Yep.
the terminologies back then. I just knew it
Yep.
made me very uncomfortable. And so during this particular meeting, it wasn't the gaslighting wasn't indirect. It was in your face, like you don't know what you're talking about. You're not a
Yeah.
team player, and you just need to shut up and you need to learn. And I was just, and so they
Oh.
And I was like, okay, fine, just get me out of here. Like,
Yeah.
I was kind of, the dean started banging on the table. And remember, I didn't know I had PTSD. And
Oh.
the banging was resembling a bell sound. And so my ears started to ring. Like, my ears were ringing. My chest got shot tight. I
Yep.
started having a panic attack and I kept saying, please stop. Like, please stop banging on the table because I needed the ringing in my ears to
Yes.
stop. And you saw him realize, like, you saw it in his eyes that he realized I was being triggered.
Yeah.
And so he banged harder.
To get
And
your
so,
attention more, or
no, I mean, he had my attention. He had the whole room's
to
attention. It
make you
was like, it was,
suffer, like
yeah, it was
what?
just kind of like to make me suffer. He's just banging. But he's, at this point, he's calling me names.
What?
And I realized no one was speaking up. Like no one was trying to stop what was taking place. And so I gathered my belongings. And so he kept
Yeah.
banging. And it was just like, and if you walk out of here, you're gonna get fired. And before I knew it, I just cussed everybody out. And I told everybody how they weren't supportive of me, how they knew I had went through what I had gone through.
If
And
if I were in that meeting, I would like to think I would follow you, and I'd be like, fuck you too. And I would like to, you know, with to show
but
you support.
It pretty much came out that way, yeah.
Well, he got one of those. It sounds like he's trying to be a bully. He's like this big bully, and they're all afraid of
the
president, right, or whoever he was.
He was the dean of the department, and so no one said anything. And so after I cussed everybody out, I was like, I'll be back to teach my class, but I'm not going to sit here and let you continue to do this to me. And so I left and I went, and there's a restaurant, because this was out in New Orleans. And so there's a restaurant that's on Lake Pontchartrain that I would go to and just sit on the water to help me calm down. And so I went, my waiter knew me, and he was like, bad day. And I was like, yeah. He was like, I got your favorite coming. And so, like, he just brought out, like, this dish I would get, the kind of sparkling water I like. And he just, like, left me alone. And he would just check on me every now and then. And I eventually calmed down. And I went back, and I taught my last class, and I told my students that I would never be back again.
Okay.
And that was it. And that was my last time working a full-time job. That was in 2016.
Well, I got two questions. One, right off the bat, were the majority of the staff, were they men?
Actually,
or was it a mixture?
That one, it was a mixture, but we had more men than women, which was unusual for that department. It's usually more women. And I did hear that after I left, one of the men did speak up, and he was just like, you know, she's went through a lot since she's been here. And he was like, and no one has given her grace. Like, no one's spoken up for her. Y'all have ignored her. And we all know that the student that she's talking about is good and certified crazy. Like, he has some issues. And no one told me what this student's issues were. I didn't find out until after I left that the student had served 7 years in prison for murder.
Oh.
He had strangled a woman to death. So what happened to me should have been a very high concern of having him lock me in the office. Like, he was dangerous.
Mm-hmm.
How do you blow that off? Like,
well, I was going to ask you, did you take any legal precautions against them?
And I tried. And so this is when you learn this. Now, this is when I started to learn about the legal system. And I learned about networking, and I learned about favoritism. And I learned that some universities know people in certain places. And so when I filed a complaint with the EEOC, someone at the university knew the person who was over my case. And so my case was dismissed because they said it lacked evidence. The lawyer that I had.
But you documented everything, right?
And that's what I told him. I was just like, you have a whole folder, like a whole year's worth of documentation. What do you mean? And he's just like, no, this isn't enough. It doesn't prove your case. And when you're going through a nervous breakdown and you're just like, you're crying and you're just like, I don't know what else to do. Like, because it was just me.
Yeah.
And so I had that happening, and I emailed the person's supervisor. Supervisor would never contact me back. I did have a lawyer. The lawyer that I had waited until the last day that you can file in federal court. And he waited until 4:30. Federal courts close at 5. And so he had been avoiding my phone calls. And so I finally talked to him and I said, you know, did you get the paperwork in? Like, today was the last day. This is like my last hope. And he was just like, you really think you're going to win? And he was just like, no, I didn't file. I'm not wasting my time. Like, you just need to. And again, I'm dealing with all men. And so it's just like, you just need to. And he's just like, I'm not filing a complaint against my alma mater. And I said, don't you think you should have told me you were a graduate of the university when you took on my case? Like, and I didn't know, you know, at that point, I'm not thinking, go to the bar, file a complaint. Because at that point, it's just like, it is over with. My statute of limitations was over with. Yeah. So there was nothing I could do. Nothing.
Okay. That sounds like a nightmare.
Yes,
I mean, I'm happy you got out of it, but I mean, I have such empathy for what you've gone through, and I'm sorry that you, any woman, especially you, or whatnot, have to go through something like that. It just, I'm sorry, nightmare, nightmare.
Yes, it truly was a nightmare. But I think again, for me, that was my turning point of I never want anyone else to go through this, especially a woman. And so because I had all this documentation, I now could actually tell people what to do, what not to do, who to go through, what your rights are, like, you know. And so I was like, not necessarily an advocate, but I just became like, I'll start sharing my story. And so when I became strong enough, I started sharing my story on LinkedIn, and I started having women to reach out to me and tell me like what was going on with them. And I would say, you need to talk to an employment attorney. And they'll be like, oh, well, they're so expensive. And I was just like, not necessarily. Like, they'll have a consultation with you, and if they think you have a case, they'll tell you how you need to proceed and what's the best avenue, and they'll give you your options. And I was like, so don't necessarily rule them out. And I had actually found a employment attorney who can actually practice in all 50 states. And so, and that's kind of rare. But he, and so I would send people to him like, hey, you guys need to go over here and talk to, you know, Attorney Bernard. He's a great guy. He's real nice, real compassionate. Will sit down and listen. Like, he will let you cry. He go pull out the Kleenex. Like, he's real
That's good.
compassionate. To say he's a lawyer. And so real, and then hearing people's stories of, oh, thank you so much. Like, he really like helped me to like understand my case and gave me my options. He didn't judge me. And so it was kind of like I had just built like this toolbox of people and resources. And so just kind of from there, just started, people would DM me and I would just help people. But didn't really start taking it seriously till like the pandemic. When people went home and were no longer in those toxic workspaces 8 hours a day, and then they realized the difference. Like at home, it was just like, oh, like I'm not anxious. Like I'm not, you know. And then again, I shared a story on social media, and this time my inbox was flooded, like with people just sharing their stories. And I was just like, what am I supposed to do with all this? Like, and they were just like, you're the first person I've ever told. Like, no, like, you know, if I tried to tell people, they just brush me off. And that's when I did the first anthology. Like, I gave them a platform to start sharing their stories. And so that anthology, Shut 'Em Down, Black Women, Racism in Corporate America. And it was 20 women that came together and shared their experiences. And we didn't realize, it actually was an Amazon bestseller, and we didn't realize the impact we had. Like, we didn't realize that we were going to be the catalyst that really allowed other women, especially women of color, to start opening up about their experiences.
What was the title of that called again?
The first anthology is Shut 'Em Down,
Shut them down.
Black Women, Racism in Corporate America.
Another important question I want to ask, because I've always been interested in this kind of stuff, where let's say you're giving a woman advice who's going through stressful events at work like this, right? Is the first step, I know documentation's important, but once something starts to happen and you feel uncomfortable, would you recommend the one or will say person to verbally tell the person to stop first, then document, or just there needs to be some verbal expression, right?
Well, there needs to be both. So you always document, even at if you haven't said anything to that person, but you need to try and establish some boundaries of letting them know that you feel uncomfortable, letting them know what the boundaries are going to be. If they cross those boundaries, like what the consequence is going to be, like what the action is going to be. So you don't over explain. You keep it short, simple, to the point. You're very direct. And this isn't, let me ask you some questions. You say what you have to say, and that's it. But then you turn around and you document and you put the date, the time that you actually had that conversation with them, what was said, who was present. Like, make sure that you're covered, that you've actually done this. 9 times out of 10, just because you set up the boundary doesn't mean that they're going to stop.
Right, absolutely. Oh, because I'm sure there's a lot of situations too where, again, I just use an example of a male and female that the male doing something, but they did not know they were making the woman uncomfortable. And this could be at school, the workplace, etc. So would that be an example of, okay, the woman actually needs to say something, and a lot of times, like, the man will be like, oh my God, I'm sorry, I had no idea I was making you uncomfortable.
Right. And so you have those instances where, yeah, they like weren't aware. And usually they're not aware because they've done it, but no one's ever told them anything. Like, people just let them go on and on and on. In my particular case, I later discovered that I wasn't the only professor, female professor, that he had harassed, that this student had. He had harassed numerous female professors on campus. My case happened to be the most severe. And that the others had went and filed, they had filed police reports. Like, there had been all of the, you're making me uncomfortable. Like, so people had tried to set up boundaries. So at some point, it became an institution problem. It became a leadership issue. And so there's only so much that you can do. And so what I had to realize was, I can't get any of these people to change. I'm going to have to change my surroundings, which meant that I was going to eventually just have to leave.
Yeah, again, like, there's so many things that people just need to be aware of. And at times, I can imagine individual, they're not used to being assertive of setting boundaries, because boundaries is an issue in mental health. Like, it's a huge issue where, again, people are just like, oh, I'd rather take being a little bit uncomfortable than actually, and maybe call it courage. Maybe you can call it courage and saying, hey, please stop, I don't appreciate it, because it can be known as an awkward situation. And sometimes people don't like awkward situations.
And it is, it can be uncomfortable, especially if you don't have like a support system. And so my other suggestion is if you feel that you're in a workspace that is abusive, that it's toxic, you need to have a tribe. You need to have a group of people that you can turn to, that are supportive, that are going to have your back. And 9 times out of 10, they are not going to be your coworkers. They're not going to be in your work environment. They're going to be away from your work environment. And they're going to be like your safe space, because you have to find a space where you are comfortable, where you feel safe, where you can open up and talk about like what you've gone through, and then allow those people to help you to navigate your situation.
It's funny, because a lot of people would think coworkers, but one thing I'm thinking about right now is, maybe you have a coworker who's doing really well at their job, and you come to them with your issues. They're like, oh, I want to help you, but I don't want to rock the boat. My job is good right now. I'm good. I wish you the best of luck.
Yes, you have that. You have people who don't want to get involved. And I had some of that in my situation, like the coworker who spoke up. We had worked like on committees together. He had chaired committees. I was the co-chair. And so, but he didn't speak up until after I was out of the room.
How do you feel about that? Are you glad that he did speak up at all, or would you have wanted him to do it in the
I
moment?
think I would have preferred if he would have spoke up in the moment that I was like, defend me. Like, you see, I'm shaking uncontrollably. You see, my eyes are glazed over. You see, I am clearly having a meltdown right now. Like, don't wait until I've left out the room and then speak on my behalf, because then it doesn't have the same impact. And then I didn't hear it. Another coworker who didn't say anything, but who knew the restaurant that I would go to, she came and found me. And she's just like, hey, I'm really sorry, but I still sat there and I said, but you didn't say anything. Like, no one came to my, and for me, that was just like, none of you came to my defense.
Well, it takes courage. So as much as sadly as it seems, because like it's a human being thing, but like things like that take courage, and who knows what was going on in their heads. Well, I'll say something else. If I stick up for her, I might get in trouble, or I might be targeted by the boss, etc. Like,
right. And then there are stats too that, like, when someone speaks up, like if you're in a toxic work environment and you decide to fight the system and you speak up, that your situation is probably going to get five times worse. That it's not going to get better.
It's the nail that sticks out gets hammered. I'm just thinking in my head right now.
Yeah, like you're disrupting. You're disrupting their dysfunction, so to speak.
The hierarchy.
And so, and instead of them taking the necessary precautions to make the changes that they need to make, they're just going to make the situation worse for you. And so that's why I really advocate for women. And I'm like, I know you really like your job, or you like the benefits, or you're this close to retirement. It's not going to stop. I'm like, that's the reality you need to face, is that what you're going through is, you can advocate all you want, is not going to change. And the more you speak out, the worse your situation is going to become.
Well, and I think a deeper way of thinking is, as human beings, what do you stand for? What are your values as a human being, and how you live your life will determine your actions in the situation that you are in too. Where it's just like, my values could be, I hate people suffering. I hate people being mistreated, and I will not be able to live with myself knowing that I see another human being suffering and I don't step in and do something. That could be an individual's values. Well, I don't care if I lose my job. I will not stand for this.
And right. Right. Yes.
Where are your values?
Yep. Right. And some people, I mean, their values are, I'm not getting in the middle of that. Y'all figure it out. It's not happening to me. Or I'm dealing with my own battles at work, my own situation at work. And so, and they're in the mindset of, if I speak up for you, that's going to make my situation five times worse. So, you know, sometimes you have coworkers that are going through their own things as well.
That is true. So in the grand scheme of things too, so like workplace trauma, is there different types of trauma, workplace traumas out there, and that people should be aware of, like categories?
Well, not necessarily categories, but I think it's stuff that we talk about when we talk about people who are like in abusive relationships, but we don't necessarily think about that in the terms of a work environment. And so, like, harassment, the bullying, you also have the discrimination that takes place, you have the microaggression, you have ageism, and ageism can happen for younger employees, older employees. So it's a lot of people think of ageism and they're thinking, oh, it's just someone who's older. That's not necessarily the case. Sometimes you have younger workers who are in an environment with older workers, and they're experiencing ageism as well. You have disability discrimination. We have gender discrimination. But according to, it's an organization out of the UK, Speak Out Revolution, and they collect data on, like, really workplace bullying. And the 70% of individuals who have reported with their agency have indicated that gaslighting was the number one experience that they had. And discrimination was number two.
I'm not surprised. I really am not. So when we think of the term, let's say sexual harassment, it could generally just mean anything that another individual does to make someone feel uncomfortable, right?
Yes. And so, but that uncomfortableness is usually going to be maybe like in a form of stalking. They're asking you to perform sexual acts in order to get a promotion. So, and it's usually there's a power dynamics that is taking place. So when I say a power dynamics, when we're talking about especially sexual harassment, there's someone who has power over the other person. And so when we look in the terms of higher ed, it's usually you're looking at like someone who's in leadership, administration, and maybe they're exerting their power over an assistant professor or staff member. I think for me, they didn't see it in those terms because it was a student. But students also have power over professors. And that's something that is often disregarded, not taken seriously. And the correct term for it is called contra power, because the power has actually reversed and the student has that power. Well, the student can get you fired. The student, it can become their word against your word. The student can go and file a police report and make it appear that you're trying to put them in a situation. But usually when it happens to faculty members, they normally don't say anything because they are fearful that that student is going to turn the situation or make it appear that the faculty member was out of order when it really was the student. So most what research shows is those faculty members would just pass that student if it's a student that they teach. Like they just want them out of their hair. They don't want to deal with them anymore. In my case, this was a student that I didn't even teach. Like I didn't even know who he was. I had to ask other students, what's his name? And then female students were just like, oh my God, stay far away from him. Like he is. I was just like, God, like, what? This guy's just a terror on this campus. And they were just like, yeah, he really is. But he, and so that's power. That's
It
power
is.
when you can terrorize an entire campus and all of the women on that campus.
And nothing's being done about it, though,
And
too.
nothing's being done. And he knows that nothing is being done, which increases his power.
Oh God, yeah. I just even in workplaces too, not so much in the sexual like harassment, but if an employee knows that they're not getting reprimanded, let's say like for example, a group counselor not following the curriculum because staff is low, we're running low on counselors, so they teach whatever they want to teach, and even when they get reprimanded, they'll never get fired, and they know that, so they'll keep doing the same thing over again. I've seen it firsthand. It's crazy.
Right, exactly.
So getting into the harassment, I'm sure it could look different ways too in different work settings. Now again, harassment's harassment no matter what. But
Right.
again, if a person does something to another person, let's say in the workplace, but the person that's it's being done to likes it and is fine with it. Okay, and I'll just use an example. When I worked at a bar and restaurant and everything, the bartenders, barbacks, and servers would be friendly with each other. And they would do things like maybe touch each other inappropriately at times. But again, if let's say a female server does that to a male server and the male server finds that woman attractive and likes it, that's not sexual harassment, even though it looks like it, because it's welcome behavior.
Right. If the behavior is welcome, both parties agree, then no, it's not. But if one of the parties is telling you like, no, I'm not comfortable with this, or they didn't invite you to engage in that behavior, then it becomes it's people crossing boundaries.
Yes. And that will happen to, let's say, going back to the male female situation where I would have this client. He was a really nice, 18-year-old boy, Isaiah. And he'd be telling me about like this woman who he worked with, an older woman. And she would walk up to him and say, like, hey, like, are you gay? And Isaiah would just be like, no, I'm not gay. And why do you say that? Well, all the cute boys are always gay. So I just wanted to like, no. And then she like rubbed his shoulder a little bit. So he's telling me, his counselor, about the situation and how it's making him feel uncomfortable, and yet how to handle that situation. Because again, men don't usually go to HR for sexual harassment.
Right. This is true. Some men, now men are starting to speak up too, because like you did the example you just gave, it doesn't, it's not just gender specific. So she's older. It sounds like she was an authoritative figure at the job. And so yes, that is a form of sexual harassment.
Right. And it's strange because when I was his age too, I was put in similar situations, but I chose not to say anything. Because, oh, I don't want to like rock the boat. It's uncomfortable, but whatever. It's whatever. And it's just like, it's telling that person, yeah, it's okay that you keep making me uncomfortable.
Right. And so, and I would say, like, if someone is in a situation like that, that is when you set the boundary. Like, you know, hey, you touching me is making me very uncomfortable. And so moving forward, I'm asking that you don't touch me. If you do touch me in an inappropriate way, my next step will be that I will file a formal complaint.
Yeah.
Absolutely. And that's it. You like, if they're like, oh, I'm sorry, like you set your boundary. You don't have to explain. You don't have to continue to engage in a conversation. You have let them know what your boundary is, that this, you find this behavior very inappropriate. And if it happens again, then you're going to do X, Y, and Z. This is what the consequence is going to be.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It was even hard for me like 3 or 4 years ago when I worked at a group home, and my coworker was like a young 25-year-old woman, and she constantly kept talking about her sex life and what she'd do to men and this and that. And at first I was just uncomfortable. I didn't say anything because it's just like, okay, weird. But then after a while, I was like, no, like I need to say something. Like, this is not like, I don't want to hear about your sex life at work. Because it's funny, we would have like, we'd almost have like a decent friendship at work. We'd talk about other things, but then she'd also talk about like sex and things. It's like, I don't want to know that. So it's just like, I almost had to like prepare myself, and it's, so I don't know. It's not embarrassing. It's just, I'm not used to doing things like this, but I had to prepare myself. Like, this is what I'm going to say to her right when I walk in the morning. I just, cause I was nervous, and it's just like, I'm not used to doing that. It's so uncomfortable and it's so awkward.
But that's actually the correct way to handle situations like that. And so you should prepare. You should know what it is that you're going to say. So that keeps you from rambling. And you know, like, okay, and this is when I'm going to say it. So having a plan, so you actually did all of the right things of thinking it through. When I go in, this is what I'm going to say. This is what I'm going to say. And so when you said it, you said exactly what you have prepared in your head. This is what, and so there is nothing else to come out. So that's the best way to handle it.
Oh, I got to tell you something else though. So it was a weekend job. So the night before, she did the same thing again, except I was so passive aggressive where I just couldn't take it anymore. So I got my stuff. Again, it's a group home and it was a corner office, but I got my stuff, my laptop, and I just went to the kitchen and spent the rest of the night like out in the kitchen. So passive aggressive. It wasn't even funny. And I feel guilty because like she knew something was up. It was an immature way of handling it. But it was like, it was a passive aggressive. It was a way to say, I'm upset with you, but I didn't have the ability to set boundaries with you, but I'm going to make you suffer anyways, or I'm going to show you, you know what I mean?
Right. And so, and that's just something that we have to be mindful of, that it's okay to prepare. It's okay to map out like what steps you're going to take, mm-hmm. because you are going to be uncomfortable. You are going to be nervous. And so being prepared helps you to really get through it. But the longer that you let it continue, if you're, you continue to be passive aggressive, the person isn't going to read your mind. And they're going to just continue. But this also lets you see, when you set boundaries, how are they with those boundaries, and do you need to take extra steps?
Yes,
because some people are still not going to respect your boundaries even after you say all of that, and you have that conversation with them. They're still going to disrespect your boundaries.
Yes.
And then that's when, and so again, you've done what you can do. Now you have to take it to HR. You need to take it to leadership, mm-hmm. and it becomes their issue.
Well, and I think that was my biggest mistake, is that I let it go on too long. And mm-hmm. So she might have thought, oh, he's okay with it. Or maybe she might have known a little bit, but didn't want to change. But I finally did. It was like, I walked in because I had to say something to her, and I was preparing. And it was just so funny because I think she knew something was coming because she was like really nervous. And I sat down, I'm like, hey, you know, can we just have more appropriate work conversations at work, please? You know, it's, And she took it very well. She actually took it very well. And
right. Yeah. So that's usually, that's, I always say that's the first step, is to, you know, identify who you need to set the boundary with. What's the boundary you need to set with them? Yep. And what is it that you need to say? And what's going to be the consequence if they cross that boundary? Like, yes. You have to establish all of that first. And then it's pretty much you letting them know.
Yep. Yep. And she, again, was very apologetic and everything. And yeah, and I just told her, hey, you know, like, I should have said this sooner, but thank you. Like, and again, she was so apologetic where I felt like I didn't need to be like, hey, and if you do this again, like, I didn't need to put salt in the wound.
Mm-hmm.
But again, we didn't really have that work friendship after that anymore. It was, I mean, it was respectful, no, but we used to goof around about like sports and other life skills and stuff, but we didn't really have that anymore. We lost that friendship, but we got more of like a professional one.
Okay.
Which is good or bad, because I miss, like, we got along great. We goof around a little bit. It's just like, I don't want to hear about the guys you hook up with or how you hook up with them. Like, that's just too much. Like, why can't we just talk about other things at work and not that? So.
Right. I get it. I get it. Yes.
You know. Oh, man. But no, like, do you think, and I want your professional opinion too on something. Like, when you're interacting with other professionals or you're on LinkedIn, do you think it's just very important that we just watch what we say, where maybe a person being like really friendly when they communicate with someone could be taken as sexual? In a sense.
I think it just depends. And again, I think if it makes an individual uncomfortable, you have to speak up and say that what is taking place is making you uncomfortable. On LinkedIn, I find that, like, I haven't ran into any of the sexual innuendos. When I first started out, I used to have people in my inbox, and I would just block them. Like, no, I'm not on here. This isn't a dating site for me.
Right.
But I've never really kind of had that issue on social media, but I have had other women to tell me how they have ran across those issues. But I also take precautions on social media. And so, like, you're not gonna, like, you never see my kids on social media.
Yep.
Like, you can't associate them with me. You also are not gonna know where I live. You're not, yep. I'm not gonna show pictures of my home. Like, I'm private to a very big extent. And for me to interact with people outside of social media, it means that I pretty much like vetted that person. So, I'm just very, very cautious. And I do realize that people can be a certain way on social media, that they're not that same person in real life. But I think for me, being cautious really escalated when I went through my situation. Of like, you know, where people say, oh no, a student couldn't do something like that. And it's just like, well, yeah, a student really can do something like that. And just not all, you know, sometimes saying you just can't look at the cover of a book. You got to go inside the book. And I look at people like that as well. And I just think if people make you uncomfortable on social media, you have the option to block them. Like, just you block them, then you're never going to see them again. Like, That's how I look at it.
And I'm just starting to think too, it's okay to be friendly with people, but don't even like be friendly, but don't be friendly in the way that it could be taken as like sexual or inappropriate. You know, just make it like a neutral, friendly comment and just don't go there, because your reputation could be greatly affected too.
Right.
If you start thinking about it.
And I think it also depends too, like on the platform that you're on. So again, like on LinkedIn, I see people move a different way on LinkedIn than they would move on like Twitter, or Instagram or Facebook. And so I think you have to take that into consideration too. And it's kind of like being mindful of your surroundings. Like, we're mindful, you know, we're told to be safe in physical spaces and to always be aware of your surroundings. I think social media is the same way. And I think, you know, again, if someone's making you uncomfortable or creepy, like on social media, the best thing to do is I'm going to block you. Like, I'm going to limit your access to me.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
you don't have to continue to put yourself in that situation.
Yeah. As we're winding down a little bit, I would love to talk more about your book.
We have three. So we have Shut Them Down, Black Women Racism in Corporate America. The next one that we did was Everyday Struggle, How Toxic Workspaces Impact Black Women, which was kind of a continuation where another group of women kind of talked about their experiences, but we didn't, that was when we kind of didn't just talk about racism, but we started talking about harassment and we started talking about like ageism. And actually doing those two books really allowed me to see like not just my situation, but what other women go through and how varied it was, how none of them had any resources. Like, so we're talking about at least 40 women. None of them had resources. None of them had support groups. People didn't believe them. You know, their experiences were negated. And for one of the anthologies, I actually had to bring in a mental health therapist because I no longer practice anymore, and bring her in to do like a debriefing. Because it was really, really bad. Like we had opened up Pandora's box and didn't realize it. And so she came in with like some tools and was like, hey, y'all need to go to therapy. Like, and none of them had been to therapy before. And as we went through that, I was just like, these women don't have any resources. They don't even know what trauma is. Like they didn't even realize what they had went through was trauma. And so I had like a journal that I had designed, and I had notes from different articles I had written. And, you know, one of my support systems, people in my support system was just like, why don't you put all of that stuff together and just release like this workbook that like defines this is what trauma is. This is what's going on with you. These are the resources. This is what you need to do if you find yourself in this situation. Like, you need to document. You need to plan an exit strategy. Like, all the stuff that basically I had done with myself, it was just like, let me give you guys the blueprint on how to navigate this situation so you can get out of the situation.
And not just like a physical one, but like a documentation one, because I remember how you got cornered in your office by that. Like, what are some like physical places you need to be physically to avoid situations?
Right. So that was where Unbreak My Soul, How Black Women Can Begin to Heal from Workplace Trauma. And I tell people that anyone can actually... My pets are just...
But don't worry about it.
So basically, that was where Unbreak My Soul came in. Because it actually, it was this is everything that you need to help you to get through this. Yes. But I always say anyone can use the workbook. So it's geared towards Black women because I talk about the additional traumas that we deal with outside of the workplace, such as generational trauma, the traumas that we're still dealing with passed down from slavery, how we deal with systemic racism in society. On top of you deal with all of that, and then you go to work.
Yes.
And then you're dealing with that layer of trauma. And so, because what I realized was a lot of Black women weren't even realizing the other traumas that were taking place in their, like, in society and their families, just in life. And so then when you start to pull all of that together, it was just like, oh, okay. So my thing was, let me get the light bulb to go off in your head so you can go and get the help that you need. Because you need to realize that it's heavy and you can't deal with all of that heaviness alone.
Oh, again, just making that awareness can be like beneficial, but like overwhelming. Like, oh my God, this is what is that been actually happening to me?
And that's usually, that has been a response to people who have actually purchased the book and have started using it. Was just like, it was like eye opening because when just me giving the definitions of the different types of traumas, like generational trauma, systemic racism, and they were like, they never looked at that as adding to what they were going through in the workplace and how it makes it even more unbearable. And then how I also, because I share stories, but sharing the stories allowed them to see that they weren't alone. that like, oh, other people go through this. And so that, not normalizing it, but helping women to see that you're not alone. Other people go through this. And so, but we've got to start having these conversations, because if we don't, it just continues and it continues to get worse.
Yeah. And you cannot fear the awkwardness, because again, got to get the conversations out. You got to talk about it. You got to make it seem like it's a normal thing, because it should be a normal thing to vent to people that you care about, or just to anyone about your issues.
Right. Exactly.
We need to normalize it.
Right. And so what I did was, the book is divided into three parts. So the first part is really giving you those definitions, the meat and potatoes, and how you're wearing armor. Every day that you go out, you put on all this armor to protect you from anything else that you might encounter, because you're tired. So you just like, okay, so then it's like, I'm not going to smile, whatever, y'all leave me alone. Like, that's armor. Then in the second half of the book, it starts talking about what are things that you can do to protect you? What are things that you can do to help you in your situation? And in the third part of the book is actually a journal, because I feel one of the things we need to do is, if we document what we go through every day and who we're talking to and what was unusual about our day. But then we also realize that we need those positive affirmations to build us back up. And so the end of the book is actually a 30-day work journal, and you use it in the morning, you use it at lunchtime while you're at work, and then you use it when you come home. So you don't just journal once in a day, you have to journal three times a day for 30 days.
Do you do like a little like assessment, like before they start and towards the end, about how they feel about the process? Like, oh wow, this made me feel so much better after the third week. I started noticing changes.
And so I didn't do an assessment in the workbook, but talking to people, because they just have a tendency to kind of tell me how they feel. Talking to them, they all have said like it was really eye-opening. Like someone said, girl, I read the first five pages and I was just like, oh, wait, I'm going through all of that. Like, and they were just like, they were like, the minute you open it up, you were educating, like it hits you right then and there. Mm-hmm. And they said that it's formatted in a way where I don't make you feel uncomfortable, but I'm laying it all out. And so it's easy to understand, and for them to see themselves like, this is me, this is what I'm going through. And the other comment that I've received is that they felt like I was in their heads, like really, you, it's like you knew what I was going through. And so I was like, thanks, like, because that was the whole point.
Do you have a particular moment where you did feel like the greatest joy from that project, making the book? Like, did someone, again, you don't need to tell us the whole like story, but like just told you how they really felt and how much they appreciated you? Was there a story about that?
They're still coming out, but I think it was like the first person who used it. And she sent me a message and said, like, I'm on page five, like, and this is eye opening. Like this, I just was dealing with one thing, and reading your definitions of trauma, I realized that I'm dealing with several things.
Yes.
And that I wasn't in therapy, and now I'm going to find me a therapist, like, because it's some stuff I need to unpack. And she said, and I haven't even gotten through the whole workbook. So like, she said, I just wanted to let you know. And then after that, the stories were very similar. And like I said, anyone can use this. I've had men to reach out. And I think that was the one. I had a guy reach out this weekend to tell me, he was like, I actually went through your workbook. And he said, then I went to work and I was just like, girl, I think you're going through some work trauma. He says, I don't start telling like my female coworkers, they need to get your book. And he was like, and so I'm gifting it to like people for Christmas. And he said, but it's really, he said, for me, it helped me to understand like my female coworkers and what they might be going through. And he said, and so now I kind of look at their situations and be like, you know, hey, what's going on? on? Like you, do you need to talk? Like I'm
Yes.
realizing to be that support system. So he was like, and I said, you actually read it? He's like, oh yeah, like it's a good book. Like so he was like, I like the exercises. So I was like, and he's using it to help like women in his workspace.
Okay. What do you think about like other things that maybe white people need to be more aware about when working with multicultural individuals, especially African American women that
I just think you have to be mindful is that like they're not just dealing with the issues at work, but that they deal with societal issues that often that we see our white coworkers and counterparts are not having to deal with. And case in point is just like we, you know, the police pulling us over, and we immediately is just like you are a fight flight. You don't know what to fright, you know, what state am I in, freeze up. And then I gotta come to work. And then I'm dealing with issues at work. Or, you know, or just seeing stuff on social media. I mean, I think when we saw what happened with George Floyd, I think the world saw it, but for people of color, for us, it was something that we've seen time and time again. It was pretty much like the world was allowed to see what we see on a daily basis. And so if it was traumatic for the world in that moment, imagine what it was, what it has been for us if we see that all of our lives.
Oh,
And
absolutely.
so our traumas, when we talk about work trauma, we have to understand that when you're dealing with people of color, that there are other traumas that they deal with that are impacted by society. Like we deal with redlining, we deal with voter suppression. You know, then like you have someone like me, I'm 53, I'm dealing with ageism in certain situations on top of all the other stuff that I'm dealing with. So as we get older, it's not like we're dealing with less, we start to deal with more.
Absolutely. No, I again, I'm just so happy for what you've done with your books and how you're helping out the community. I just you're helping out thousands of people. I just know you are. I just that I can't
But
imagine
that
what
is my goal. That's what I'm hoping is taking
that's
place.
beautiful. That really
Thank
is.
you.
It really is. And just as we end things, wind things down, what are your goals for the next like 3 to 5 years? Do you have any more future projects? Maybe another book along the way?
Now, right now, it's just me running my agency, I Think Change, and we do like research for different, we actually collect data for different agencies for different projects that they're working on. So working to grow that, doing more speaking. But like, yeah, after I did Everyday Struggle, I said I wasn't doing another book. And then here came Unbreak My Soul. So can't say if I'm gonna do another book right now. It's probably the answer is like no, is what I'm thinking. Yeah, and probably I say next 5 years, like travel and just enjoying
Nice.
life. Like, yeah.
Well, you deserve
Thank
it.
you.
And if any of my listeners do want to get a hold of you, what's the best way for them to do that?
I'm definitely on LinkedIn, Dr. Kiri Yazzie. You can also visit my website, drkiriyazzie.com. As you can see, branding, everything. Finding me is you put in Dr. Kiri Yazzie in Google and I'm going to pop up Instagram, Twitter, LinkedIn, and also my website.
Well, absolutely. And to all my listeners, I will put her book, our books information on my show notes, as well as her emails, social media. So she'll be one click away for you.
Yes.
Well, Dr. Carey, it was such a blessing to have you on the show. Thank you so much.
Well, thank you so much for having me. I really appreciated this conversation. I enjoyed it.
Thank you. I just want to thank Dr. Carey for another wonderful behavioral health integration episode. It was a pleasure. I learned so much from her and had a great time. I also want to thank all of my listeners for your support. I would not be here without you. I also want to inform everyone that the information expressed in this episode was not meant to be taken as therapeutic advice. If you do find yourself struggling with any type of mental health or addiction issues, please seek the care of a licensed medical doctor or a licensed mental health professional. And if anyone does want to make contact with me, my email is behavioralhealthintegration121@gmail.com. I also have a website called behavioralhealthintegration.org. So if anyone wants to leave a comment, send me an email, that's how you would do it. Also, please write reviews if you want to. Those are greatly appreciated and would help me out a lot. All right, everyone, until next time, have a good day. Bye.